Sarath Ganji is the director of the Autocracy and Global Sports Initiative and a fellow at the Center for New American Security. And he's here to talk with us about some things that are in the news almost every day. And we'll get to those. Sarath, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
If you see on the video here that a little bit of LSU creeping in the t-shirt here, Sarath is a Louisiana native and, of course, is trumpeting LSU's championships recently in women's basketball and most recently in the Men's College World Series. So congratulations to all Louisianans for such triumph.
Of course. I love it.
So Sarath is educated in D.C. and at the Kennedy School in Boston at Harvard, and has sort of made his life now in the last few years talking about things like sports washing. So let me first start with this. What is Autocracy and Global Sports Initiative? How did it get started? What's it all about?
Yeah, 2 years ago, I was working at the Department of State for a couple of different offices, one having to do with foreign assistance to countries overseas. And then the second was the department's intelligence agency called the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. And the more I got to work on really fascinating issues around development finance, foreign direct investment, sort of the ways that democracies versus autocracies get involved in different globalized sectors of the world economy, the more I started noticing different patterns around how, say, democracies get involved in sectors like sports versus autocracies. With autocracies, we find that there is a more strong-fisted, visible force emanating from the government itself, something that we don't often see from democratic governments, who tend to take more of a back seat in markets, private markets, and global markets. And so I was really fascinated by this issue. I used to live in the UAE, first working for the Department of State, and then later doing an independent research as a Fulbright scholar. And I was looking at medical tourism, actually, the idea of patients crossing borders in search of cheaper, more affordable, but also kind of fancier and more fun healthcare. And I noticed that the same infrastructure underlying the Emiratis and the Qataris and the Saudis' investments in healthcare, you see it across any number of sectors. And so it's not just sports or healthcare that we can be talking about. We could apply this whole conversation to higher education, to the media, to academia like think tanks, to tech and commerce. And so I happened to take up the sports angle first in 2021 because the World Cup was coming up, the Beijing Olympics were coming up, and I had previously done some field work in Qatar and its construction camps around World Cup preparations. And so it just seemed like a very timely way to finesse all of those interests into one particular potent vehicle.
So we talk in our business about something called cultural imperialism, where we talk about how the United States for decades has exported its culture through movies, through television, through sports, through Levi's, through Nikes, through all of these things. So is there any relationship there? The U.S. has done a really good job of letting the rest of the world know who they are and what they are, even though they don't say, this movie is about who we are, but we're shooting and killing and blowing up stuff, and we believe in the Second Amendment. Is there any kind of relationship there?
There's two sides to the cultural imperialism coin, right? So on the positive side, we might call it soft power. This is a term that goes back to a Harvard professor, Joseph Nye. I was a student of his about a decade ago, and he wrote a book back in 1990 called Bound to Lead, and then subsequently wrote additional books like The Paradox of American Power, The Future of Power, also just a book simply titled Soft Power. And across it, he's trying to point out that back in the 1980s, as people were prognosticating the end of the United States' post-war run as a global power and the rise of a Japan and a Soviet Union, a Russia in particular, he was trying to say that all those analysts were too focused on military industrial might, and that there's all this world outside of it that's a little softer, a little more cultural. We can't really explain it, but it's tied to that indescribable, indefatigable quality of what it is to be American. And that quality ends up being really attractive and persuasive to foreign governments, foreign audiences, the wider world. And so he called that term soft power and suggested that the way the U.S. can project influence to move minds and bodies around the world, it's not just through military might or economic strength. It's through soft power. It's through our sports and entertainment industries and the ways in which it can inspire K-pop and J-pop and the entertainment sectors of, say, Bollywood and Mollywood in India. And so that's sort of the positive side of what America's cultural reach might mean. The more negative side, exactly to what you stated, is maybe an appropriation element to all of it. You can almost see culture as zero sum. To what extent does my influence crossing into your country impede on that country's own definition of itself and its own identity? And then the contest between those two things ends up producing a kind of synthesis. Is that synthesis genuine? Is it authentic? Or is it an outgrowth of imperialism of some kind? I don't really have good answers on that latter point. I think that's a conversation for all of us to decide individually. Me being an Indian American growing up in the American South, I certainly have a lot of different fusions of culture embodied in who I am, including the t-shirt I'm wearing now, alongside a name that is not at all a Louisiana name. But I think those influences, by and large, end up being something that operates outside the military, industrial space, and sports entertainment end up being really key vehicles for it.
So, Sarath, you're a critic of sports washing, and we're going to talk about sports washing in a minute here. But I want to set the table with this idea that the NBA has been doing business in China for 20 years. They didn't learn yesterday that Chinese have been subjugating the Uyghurs and have been slaughtering minorities. I'm sorry if that's a too strong a word, but so put that into perspective for me. The NBA players are readily available to be critical of American culture, politics, which is good. But then when the commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, says, zip it up on China, they zip it up on China. So give me some perspective on that, if you would, please.
Yeah, I'll take a couple of cuts at it. And maybe we can lump into this conversation just the idea of shut up and dribble, or politics has nothing to do with sports. I think all of that is tied together. If we zoom out for a little bit, you'll find that the century and a half evolution of global sports has gone through three stages. The first was professionalization, the second was commercialization, and the latest is internationalization. Professionalization goes back to, you can even talk about 19th century soccer in England and how you had a bunch of people kicking around a soccer ball, a football, and to what extent could you do that just for fun on the weekends versus getting paid a salary to do it professionally according to certain rules. And so we saw these decades old movement toward professionalization, creating the Football Association, the FA, having different tiers of leagues, having a promotion and a relegation system, having championships at the end of a season versus knockout tournaments, all of that coming together over many decades. Around the 19, maybe 60s or 70s, and I use soccer / football as my north star on this one because it seems to have been one of the older sports to have gone through these stages faster than a lot of the other big sports out there, including gridiron football, footsie and basketball and cricket. But with football, you saw the rise of FIFA, the federation that dominates global soccer, right? They're the head of the World Cup. And in the 70s, they started focusing on commercialization, as opposed to having a bunch of sort of nonprofit clubs that are engaging in the sport for the sake of the fans, and having nonprofit, publicly owned clubs, the way the Green Bay Packers are publicly owned today. You started seeing a transition to having privately owned companies, and then eventually ones where they were effectively joint stock companies. You could have public shares in them. You also saw partnerships on the media rights side with big broadcasters wanting to take these games that people love seeing in person and putting on the TVs so that it can be beamed into the households of average everyday folks who couldn't make it out to the games, couldn't afford to necessarily, but definitely wanted to catch up on their soccer. You also started seeing sponsorships. So Coca-Cola was a big early entrant into the world of FIFA and soccer sponsorships going back to the 70s. All of a sudden, you started seeing more money pour into the game. And this was great because the finances of soccer in particular, and especially in Europe, are pretty shaky. When you think of the promotion relegation system, if you get relegated from the top tier Premier League to the next tier, that is a ton of media revenue and a ton of sponsorship revenue that you're losing out on, to the point that the Premier League has to offer you what's called a parachute payment to help soften the blow of moving down to a second tier group. Because of those shaky finances, it's the diversification of revenue streams that teams have been looking to shore up their bottom lines. And where local or national sponsors and broadcasters can only go so far, international sources of finance became more pertinent. And so in the late 90s, you had the first foreign-born owner, an Egyptian, taking over a team in the Premier League. And you've seen a steady increase in the number of foreign owners in the Premier League, to the point that maybe 3 or 4 years ago, you had 12 out of 20 of the Premier League teams that were owned by foreign groups, including the sovereign wealth funds of foreign governments. Now there's different ways that those foreign investment vehicles manifest in the Premier League. But by and large, it's those international sources of funding that have introduced a whole lot of novelty into what it means to do sports and be an athlete today. And some of that novelty behind internationalization is the connection between American sports and foreign countries whose governments are repressive, brutal, overbearing. And so, whereas back in the day, a Daryl Morey, who was a GM of the Houston Rockets, could speak about China's brutal, repressive surveillance state practices toward the Uyghurs in Western China, and it wouldn't matter. The internationalization of basketball by way of having, say, Mikhail Pokorov take over the Brooklyn Nets at one point in time, having an NBA team store in the United Arab Emirates, having NBA Africa, which, of course, Dikembe Mutombo, a Georgetown great, Hoya Saxa, was very much connected to. All of these have introduced internationalized connections, cross-border connections. And there's a lot of good to have with that, right? Spreading the game and all American sports around the world, kind of your point about soft power / cultural imperialism. The problem is when the Chinese state says your values regarding democracy, the open press, human rights are impinging on how we do things here within the Chinese Communist Party's country, that ends up creating this cultural clash. And now you have athletes and GMs trying to figure out how to navigate that. And so I guess I would say, by and large, sports and politics have always been interconnected. This goes back to the ancient Greek Olympics and the way the Athenians tried to parlay their efforts in chariot racing to become big deal politicians. It goes back to the 1934 Italian World Cup under Mussolini to project Italian strength after a tough defeat in World War I, the Nazi Olympics 2 years later, the 78 Argentinian World Cup. Politics has always been a part of sports. And whereas once upon a time, you had fans who thought sports was an escape, it's really hard for the athletes themselves to escape that when their sources of revenue are coming from foreign governments as much as local ones.
So are we then to just eschew the notion that that moral character, that moral decisions are made, because what will trump everything in this is the financial relationship?
It's a tough balance. Maybe the way I would frame it is based on the UN Business and Human Rights Framework. We tend to think of the moral and the practical as two separate worlds, right? But it turns out that the moral introduces certain kinds of risks, and those risks have bottom line financial, legal, reputational consequences. And so the way that the UN set about creating this framework was to tell corporations, hey, we know you have to invest in oil or mining or other kinds of companies around the world, other kinds of industries that might create environmental harm, hurt communities, damage lives. But think of it this way. It's not just about you giving up morality in order to care about your bottom line. When you damage those communities, you invite protests from those communities that requires you to pay more for security forces, which cuts into your profits. When you get sued by different stakeholder groups, and now you're tied up in millions of dollars worth of multi-year legal settlements and disputes, that hurts your bottom line. And so it turns out there's actually a kind of financial piece to acting immorally. And that financial piece is just the way we price risk. Moral risk ends up creating bottom line risk. And so I think those two worlds are actually very much connected. It's just that we haven't really had a good conversation in the sports world not yet at least, around how do we price that risk and weigh it against just the pure financial bottom line. I think we're now starting to see that conversation come about in the sports sector the way it's come about in any number of other sectors.
Sarath Ganji is a fellow at the Center for New American Security, a director of the Autocracy and Global Sports Initiative. I'm John Schrader. So sports washing is a term that I don't know how old it is, but certainly has come into the forefront in the last, I'm guessing, 12 to 24 months. So quickly give us a definition of what you believe sports washing is, and then we'll get into conversations about what the Saudis are doing with golf and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so I'm a big sports fan. I read my ESPN and my Sports Illustrated and The Athletic every day, as I'm sure your viewers and students hear often and come across often. Sports washing in the last 2 years has exploded. And it typically is defined in those news articles as a shorthand for propaganda or image management or nation branding or reputation laundering. Those are all somewhat in the ballpark of what it means, but not quite there. So I would say sports washing, quite simply, is two things. It's one part malign finance and one part information manipulation. So to help concretize that, let me give you a quick origin story of the term. Back in 2015, the country of Azerbaijan, which is located in southeastern Europe, it was preparing to host the European Games, which was Europe's version of the Olympics. It was going to be the first time Europe was doing this event. The president of Azerbaijan is a dictator, Ilham Aliyev, who's been around since 2003. Now, having been around that long, he is able to have cemented his reach, his influence, his control by being an authoritarian, meaning he's an absolutist. He doesn't have to care about good versus bad decisions and being held accountable to it because he doesn't have to worry about being challenged in free and fair elections. He's a clientelist, which means he has personal private access to the country's public funds and can use them as he pleases. And then he's paternalist, meaning he has a huge security apparatus, a police force, a military that can repress and bring into line anyone who might detract or oppose his agenda and his regime, right? And so he's used that toolkit, that authoritarian toolkit throughout the prior 10 plus years preceding 2015. But there's another quirk to what he did. In order to brandish his reputation to foreign audiences, maybe even distract people from the brutal repressive ways that his police state was policing folks domestically, he would spend large sums of government funds on major international sporting events. So the European Games of 2015 was one of them. He hosted the Islamic Solidarity Games, one of their iterations. I believe there was a big Formula One race in Baku that happens every year. A chess Olympiad was there as well. The point of all these events was to say, all these other countries might think I'm repressive, but here is the image of a modern, pro-competitive entertainment sports country. And by doing this, we can invite foreign audiences to come in as tourists, see for themselves how great the cities that we have carefully chaperoned come off as to those tourists. And in the process, we will brandish me, the dictator's image, and Azerbaijan's image in a more positive light globally, right? So all that was taking place up through 2015. You had a group of human rights organizations come together to form a coalition called the Sport for Rights Campaign. And the idea they had in mind was, okay, well, there's two sides to this coin. On the one hand, Aliyev is trying to use sports and these bigger national events to brandish a positive image, but it also means that you have an international spotlight being shined domestically on what's happening. Let's use our voices strategically during this period to talk about what's happening to our activists and our journalists and our opposition leaders and our protesters. And let's try to get the international community to pay attention through this vehicle of international sports on what's happening domestically and why this regime is bad. And so they formed this coalition. The coordinator for that coalition, Rebecca Vincent, was a former American diplomat based in Baku, had finished her tour there, went back to the United States, heard about all of her friends, former colleagues and contacts being brutally repressed, came back to the country to be a part of this coalition. And she penned an op-ed in which she talked about how the strategy of the Aliyev's regime is to use sports to whitewash his and the country's reputation, ergo sports washing. And so that 2015 op-ed was the first time the term came about. It really wasn't used much over the next few years, but it was in 2020, 2021, and then especially last year when the World Cup, the Beijing Olympics, Saudi Arabia's takeover of Newcastle, the growth of Manchester City into a recently treble-winning team, and then, of course, Liv all really brought this to the fore. And just two things I'd point out about that story of Azerbaijan, the origin story. The first is none of this ability to position one's brand globally could be possible without a lot of unaccountable money that was being run through the personage of a single leader. That's malign finance. And second, and I would say this is sort of a more epistemological moral argument, is when you commit human rights abuses, when you detain, arrest, disappear people, you can't undo that action. It's there in reality and it'll forever be there. But what you can do is obstruct how knowledgeable people are about that information, to what extent it enters their echo chambers, their information spheres. And so when it comes to using sports to manipulate the information spheres of audiences domestically and especially internationally that you care about, their opinions and perceptions, that's information manipulation. And so that's why sports washing ends up being part malign finance and part information manipulation.
So Mohammed bin Salman, the absolute ruler, the son of the king of Saudi Arabia, has taken this to brilliant, massive turns, right? I mean, he is writing the book on this. And you know, as you suggest, you know, there's just ridiculous amounts of money that he's throwing out here. But how essentially has he done it? How has it worked?
He came to power once his dad came to power, right? Eventually, I believe it was in 2017, becoming the de facto ruler by way of becoming crown prince, taking over a lot of key federal departments. There was a two-year purge. We heard stories of lots of his competitors, royals, businessmen being detained in a Ritz-Carlton. And so
not just competitors, Sarath, family members. I mean, these are cousins, distant cousins. These are people who he perceived as any kind of competition to his reign.
Exactly. And so one of the sources of power that he wanted to elbow out his competitors from was the country's sovereign wealth fund, the public investment fund, PIF. Now, PIF has been around, I believe, going back to the 1970s, but it was largely a passive vehicle that just took in the rents from the country's hydrocarbon economy, its oil exports. It was in 2014 when new rules promulgated by the Saudi government turned the public investment fund into a more active investor in businesses domestically, but also internationally. And so when you're talking about an investment vehicle that today has close to $700 billion in assets under its umbrella in-house, that ends up becoming a really potent piggy bank for MBS to try to use the financial leverage of his malign finance overseas. And so as a result, he's been able to invest in a lot of different industries. And so there's Meta, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram. There's Disney, the parent company of ESPN, ABC Sports, Live Nation. If you are a Taylor Swift fan trying to get a concert through Ticketmaster, you can blame Live Nation for some of those problems. And then, of course, you have Newcastle, the English Premier League team in 2021, and then LIV Golf more recently, all of which are being financed by the public investment fund. And so it's become a kind of financial vehicle for achieving MBS's international geopolitical interests.
So Live Nation is a for-profit company, and that's good. Meta is a company that is for-profit. But how in the world could you even suggest that offering a soccer player $200 million a year is any kind of revenue-producing business decision? It seems as though a lot of these decisions are made not necessarily with the idea of making money, which is what most people in business do, right? The idea is, you know, keep the labor costs down, keep your operating costs down, and your profits up, and you make some money. But this seems antithetical to that in some ways, or am I just naive?
I'm with you on that. I think to a quote by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, that the propensity to truck, barter, and trade with one another is fundamental, is inherent in human nature. And so if we're talking about humans, we're talking about markets. And if we're talking about markets, then we're talking about systems to help them flourish. Ideally, that's capitalism. But a problem comes into play when we start allowing big governmental actors to make their way into markets. Now, certainly there are reasons for it. There are distortions in a market, what we might call negative externalities, and government is there to maybe help plug some of the holes resulting from those externalities. But a sovereign wealth fund is a government actor, and not just any government actor, but a big spending, ambitious, largely unaccountable foreign government actor. And so when it starts entering markets, including, say, the American sports market or the English sports market, it creates all kinds of distortions, economic and political. And that's what's troubling to those who are critics of Saudi malign finance and what the Public Investment Fund is doing in particular, is it should seem like what they're spending is meant to generate a return on their investments in a non-oil and gas sector as a way to help wean the country's economy off of a hydrocarbon source that is going to run out and is going to end up hurting their domestic economics and their decades-old social contract with citizens and royals in particular in these countries in Saudi Arabia. But exactly to your point, when you're spending as big as they are, it's not altogether clear what return on investment you're making in these sectors. There was a recent report by the International Monetary Fund showing that of the G20 countries, Saudi Arabia was the fastest growing economy in the world last year, I believe 8.5% growth. But that wasn't growth that came from anything the Public Investment Fund was doing in global sports or entertainment. It was through their hydrocarbon wealth and being able to control domestic inflation. So we haven't yet seen empirically the return on investment from the sports entertainment properties. But even more than that, we have proof that they have been willing to spend big for a number of years without needing to generate a return on investment. The New York Times did a great expose of Project Wedge, the 2021 consulting feasibility study run by McKinsey and Company that eventually led to LIV Golf. And in it, McKinsey lays out a few different scenarios that a homegrown Saudi pro golf league could end up becoming. And one of those scenarios is a startup that just continues to lose money. Another scenario is a self-sustaining league that displaces the PGA Tour. But it's fascinating to me that within the context of that study, Saudi Arabia was willing to lose $2 billion over a multi-year period in order to get it off the ground. Exactly to your point, that's not an economic rationale for doing anything.
Sarath Ganji is the director of the Autocracy and Global Sports Initiative and a fellow at the Center for New American Security. I'm John Schrader. Just for the record here, the National Football League does not allow sovereign fund investment, but the NBA does, and they just got a little bit of one with the company that owns the Wizards. The NHL does as well, the company that owns the Wizards and the Capitals and the Mystics. I would guess that the NFL will at some point, because they're as greedy as any human beings on the planet, will figure out how to do this. But my question here is not about that, but let me ask you to put yourself in Phil Mickelson's shoes or Karim Benzema's shoes or Ronaldo's shoes or Cameron Smith and say, okay, I took the $100 million. Let me explain to everybody why I took that $100 million and why it's okay. Could you do that for me?
So let me try the authentic yet obviously cynical version of this. If I'm Cameron Smith, hey, I'm just a golfer. I'm paid to put a ball in the hole. To the extent that I can take the game of golf and bring it to new audiences, I'm happy to. And yes, there might be some downsides to it, but by and large, there's a net benefit, a net positive. And in the process, as long as I'm in the room with Saudi officials and the Public Investment Fund, for example, then I can have conversations about the way women are treated in Saudi Arabia, the way, like you said, family members of the regime, along with business people, can be detained and arrested just for being competitors. And if I happen to assassinate a Saudi journalist like Jamal Khashoggi, so be it. By and large, what the regime is doing is getting from point A absolute abuses of rights, to point B, trying to become more respecting of human rights, and the progress from A to B is going to be a tough one, a meandering one, but eventually we'll get there. So what I just said is basically what you heard any number of PGA Tour and LIV golfers say over the last 2 years. And essentially their rationalizations were, one, I'm going to do a cost-benefit analysis, but I'm going to ignore most of the costs and just talk about the benefits. And it's mostly because I don't really know what the costs are, because I'm not that familiar with the domestic Saudi situation of its public or its huge labor migrant population, 45% of the population, or what exactly its geopolitical intentions are more broadly. That's just not something I'm ready to talk about. Two, interaction and engagement with people is always better than non-interaction, even if I don't quite know how to be persuasive in those meetings to convince government officials that their human rights record is problematic and needs to be changed. And so we heard those rationalizations over and over again, and it never quite washed for me, because then you hear the third piece, which is, I'm just an athlete, I shouldn't have to care about the politics piece. And it goes back to what we said before about people trying to think of entertainment and sports as escapism, and so keep the politics out of it, except you're in the politics, and it's just a matter of you're choosing to be ignorant about it.
So what do you then make of the latest development in this? And that is suddenly, and help me if I mispronounce this, Yasser El-Rumayyan is the head of LIV Golf. He's also the chairman of the Aramco, which is the state oil company, and several other sovereign funds. I mean, he's pretty close to the king, right? He's pretty close to the crown prince. What do you make of that when he and Jay Monahan show up on television and say, oh, the things we've been saying about each other for the last year and all the lawsuits and all that stuff, forget about that. We're now partners. What do you make of that?
The hypocrisy is stunning, right? It sounds to me like if you can make a pitch to the public, as Jay Monahan, the PGA commissioner, did, built on a series of tools, and you have the financial tool, and you have the historical tool, and you have the moral tool. That's all the moral piece really was part of his influence arsenal. And the moment the financial tool and the legal tool didn't really work out is the moment he had to give up on those two. And the moral one was just not significant enough in his calculation to stand the test of time. And so that remarkable June 6th interview on Squawk Box, where he essentially overturned all the things he said about the Saudi connection to 9/11 or the human rights abuses that the government has committed, Jamal Khashoggi and his assassination dismemberment. All of those things went out the window so quickly. And it's interesting that in the days following that interview, you had heated conversations with, for example, in Canada, a number of players. Rory McIlroy had an intriguing interview a day, maybe 2 days after that press conference, where that announcement, where he called himself a sacrificial lamb and essentially resigned himself to the fact that, well, if Saudi money is going to be in the game in some way or another, at least let's make it work for us instead of against us. And so you could tell that he was really, I love Rory McIlroy. I think he is a critical thinking, sympathetic, honest kind of guy. And so for him to really be wrestling with these two issues, you can tell it was tough for him. I think he ended up being persuaded, in effect, just based on his statements at that press conference, that, you know, we, through corporate governance and the PGA's sort of umbrella corporate board over this new company, can rein in whatever excesses come with malign finance from the public investment fund. We'll see if it stands the test of time. I think he was pretty realistic in saying, yeah, I hope this will work out, but it's tough to tell.
The way I see it is, and again, I don't study this every day like you do, but a PGA Tour runs golf and they do it really well. They organize it, they plan it, they do it really well. Saudi Arabia has all this money, but in the end, if there's a tussle between who's paying for it and who's managing it, we know who wins that tussle. And that's what I keep thinking in the back of my head. Yes, Saudis don't run golf. If you've watched LIV Golf on television, it looks like access cable. And I really like the announcer, Arlo White. I was disappointed he went to work for them. I know Arlo from my days of being a soccer broadcaster, and I really like him. I was disappointed when he did that, but I understand, you know, because they probably threw him gobs of money as well. And but they just don't do it very well. The PGA Tour does do it really well. But I don't think it's that simple. It's we're going to put all this money in there and run these golf to help you fund all these golf tours. PGA, you guys know how to do that. I'm not naive enough to think that's the way it's going to work.
I think that's totally right. And just to offer an analogous example, when the public investment fund took an 80% stake in Newcastle, the Northeastern English Premier League team, who, you know, had an incredible season, a huge turnaround between 2011 and 2021 and 2022, and now will be in the Champions League next year. The reason they passed the Premier League's directors and owners test for being suitable to become a majority controlling owner of a Premier League team is because they said the public investment fund has no connection to the Saudi government. The Saudi government is not going to in any way make decisions on behalf of this team. And the notion of financial doping, bringing in all of the different, say, Saudi-connected entities to pour money into the team to give them a financial advantage, sort of an economic distortion in the market to outspend other teams and thereby guarantee their success, none of that would come into play. There would be clear, bright lines preventing that. That should have meant that there wouldn't be any Saudi sponsors pouring additional money into the team. And instead, what we saw is Noon, a kind of Saudi, I believe, retail tech company, becoming the shirt sleeve sponsor of the team. And the tricky thing about these sponsorship agreements is we don't really get details on what's in them. All we know is they last probably a few years with the sleeve sponsorship that can probably run anywhere from 5 to 15 million per year. But in terms of what are the rules and regulations placed on that, and then how many more Saudi companies can come in and pour even more money into the club, those are clear bright lines that the public investment fund had committed to not stepping over. And then within just a matter of months, they did that. And to see where that bright line can go, just look at Manchester City, which is owned by the UAE Minister of Presidential Affairs, the company that he runs. The team was bought back in 2008, I believe, by the Emiratis. It just won a historic treble, which is incredible. But back in February, a little notice press release came out from the Premier League saying that the team, going back to 2009, so about 12, 13 years, had over 100 financial violations that would now be investigated. It was a very anodyne, tough to read legalese document. So I'm not quite sure what all those financial violations were, but just imagine first bringing in an Emirati government-linked funding source. This was a private equity firm run by Sheikh Massoud of the UAE to purchase the team. And then you started getting all of these sponsorship agreements from Emirati entities, and the money came pouring in and the violations came pouring in. That's the set of bright lines that a sovereign foreign actor can violate in these situations. And that would be my worry when it comes to the public investment fund pumping money into golf, or when it comes to the new Qatari investment authority pumping money into the DC sports scene.
Yeah, it seems so fundamentally elemental to remind folks that Saudi Arabia is not a republic. It's not a parliamentary system. It's a kingdom. It's the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, right? And the Emirates are Emirates. They're run by the monarchs. They're not republics. They're not parliamentary. They are monarchies. And the U.S., capitalism, of course, but we do have some regulation. In the last 40 years, it's been chipped away at considerably in the way business is allowed to operate in this country. But there are some checks and balances, and there really aren't in the people we're talking about.
Exactly.
What happens now? Saudis are proving that they can do, and they will continue, right? There's just no reason to believe that they're not going to take some more hundreds of billions of dollars of that $700 billion they have to get into other businesses. I'm sure they're lobbying Congress. I'm sure they're lobbying National Football League owners right now, who love to sell 5 or 10% of their teams for, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and put all that money in the bank and buy another yacht. So where do we find, is there a balance? Where are we at with this right now?
Yeah, maybe two principles I'll point out. The first is that when cash-strapped democracies retreat from a sector, resource-rich autocracies advance. So during the financial crisis, we found a number of financial institutions in the United States and the UK having to deal with liquidity runs, and those liquidity runs result in either them having to close down, having to be bought up by another institution, having to be nationalized by their governments. But in the case of, say, Barclays Bank in the UK, they just turned to the closest Middle Eastern sheikhs, in this case it was the Qatari sheikhs, and got a huge injection of investment from them that staved off nationalization by the United Kingdom government. Over the next several years, they were investigated by multiple UK authorities, the local and national level, for lots of irregularities. And so the challenge is that in so many different sectors of the global economy, and we were talking before about not just sports entertainment, but healthcare and higher education, the media and academia, especially in a post-COVID world, bottom lines and finances are shaky. How do you balance a balance sheet that has to deal with students trying to come to universities and have the old experiences they did, but now having to reconcile with different learn from home procedures and professors work from home procedures? And so that's why you're seeing internationalization, looking for foreign sources of finance, playing such a big role in these sectors. And so there's sort of a two-sided coin, but there's also one here too, where if the money coming from a Gulf autocrat ends up giving them leverage in the machinery of the sports and entertainment sector to be able to use the players and the teams, the federations and the sponsorship and broadcasting contracts in the ways they do to exert influence across borders, well, then the deeper they sink their teeth into those sectors, the more we have control within open societies on those teeth. The question is, have we laid the infrastructure, the regulatory infrastructure, the transparency, disclosure and accountability infrastructure to make those teeth apparent and then be able to disclose what's taking place? And so, you know, with the LIV Golf Tour, as they were battling in the courts with the PGA, they tried to have it both ways. They tried to say, on the one hand, we are not being controlled by the Saudi government, so you don't have to worry about a foreign government playing a role in golf. On the other hand, to deflect the PGA trying to, as part of the discovery process, get documents from the Public Investment Fund to pose PIF officials, they claimed sovereign immunity. Right, that they were beyond the reach of American courts last year, which is astounding. Right, they gave up the game, and so we just need to put into place the right foreign agent reporting requirements, the right financial disclosure and transparency requirements, and then also just put into place a sense of what it means to properly screen investments, not just in infrastructures we think matter to national security, like ports or like cyber. Or national defense institutions and power plants, but also sports, because it's such an important part of the lifeblood of communities economically and socially. And that's where I think Gulf autocrats have been pretty shrewd, is in realizing these are under-regulated sectors, they're not considered critical infrastructure, and so they can make their moves there and then leverage it in other sectors elsewhere.
I'll have one comment and then a question related to that. One of the greatest values in America is capitalism. I mean, yes, freedom and freedom of speech and liberty and all of the things that we celebrate. But I would argue that our greatest value as a country to many people is capitalism. So then if that's the case, then the devil's advocate says, okay, it's a free market. Okay, let it go, right? But I agree with your suggestion, not suggestion, in fact, that sports is such a big part of who we are. And there probably are few businesses in the world whose value is increasing at the incredible percentages that professional sports are in America, some places around the world. But look at the Dallas Cowboys are worth $8 billion. He paid Jerry Jones paid $150 million for them in 1989, and now they're worth $8 billion. They haven't won a championship in 30 years, right? So it's nuts. The Golden State Warriors build a billion-dollar palace and their value doubles. It's crazy. How do we reconcile this idea that, yes, we are a capitalist country, and sometimes capitalism is not good for us, if that's the case?
There is an underlying current within the conversation of what do we do with this outside spending that seems to be kind of protectionist. It's almost as if we should treat, ironically, billion-dollar franchises, infant industries, going back to what Thomas Jefferson used to call our small farmers and our small companies in America in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And you protect them from foreign competition, help them grow, and then they can stand on their own legs. And surely you would think a multi-billion-dollar American company is well to do within the global market to stand on its own legs. But there are all these new vehicles for investment because of internationalization and all these really thorny questions about who gets control of what in the decision-making process, the slippery slope of finance taking over and eating the culture and the logistics of an organization and decision-making, that it injects a lot of uncertainty into that equation. I guess what I would say about the capitalism piece is, back when I was still living in Louisiana, I spent a summer in 2010 being a part of those really contentious town hall debates about the Affordable Care Act, about Obamacare, right? You remember those happening all across the country. And one of the big things I used to hear about in those town halls is how if you introduce a public option into a private market, you're going to crowd out all the private insurers, and it's going to leave the government left standing because it has a lot of non-economic motives involved, often rightly so, when it comes to healthcare, education, housing, and it has the deepest pockets of any entities involved. So it can outlast all the other entities. Now imagine having a public option in sports. And to me, that's what the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia or the Qatar Investment Authority of Qatar or the multiple sovereign wealth funds of the UAE are doing, is they're injecting a public option that no private enterprise can fully outcompete. And so I guess to me, it seems as if protectionism, as maybe icky of a word as it might seem or disingenuous of a word, is almost needed to ensure that when one team gains an advantage from having a deep-pocketed foreign government investor, all the other teams are now not racing to the bottom to try to keep up. And that's what we're seeing in the Premier League now. And the question is, do we want the NBA or the NFL to become the Premier League when it comes to the explosion of money and just how difficult it is for the fans to keep up, particularly when you have, say, a Russia-Ukraine war in the background that removes your owner, Roman Abramovich of Chelsea, or when you have a whole government ministry of sport trying to figure out how to, in part, publicize a number of teams. Those are all problems that will be more at the front of what we see in American sports if we don't figure out a better way to deal with foreign government financing.
So I don't want this to sound political. It's not. This is the fact. Jared Kushner, weeks after being an official part of the Trump White House, takes $2 billion from the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. How do we reconcile that in our view here?
You're right. I've spent quite a bit of time looking at the Foreign Agents Registration Act filings on the Department of Justice website, the FARA filings. And anytime a foreign government pays a U.S. lobbying firm or law firm or consulting firm to help them with the comms campaign domestically, you can find those files on that website. You're supposed to. That's what FARA is meant to do, is help increase transparency. I can't find any of these meetings between, say, a Jared Kushner or a Donald Trump or any Republican or Democratic figures on the sidelines of a LIV Golf event. And that's what's challenging to me, is it's an informal form of lobbying that is not being disclosed or reported and yet can have just as dire ramifications to the way a foreign government is spin doctoring itself in the domestic media discourse.
Well, Surath, this is a fascinating area for me. I'm delighted that we have people like you who spend your days and months and years studying these kinds of things. And we appreciate you giving us, we've sort of scratched the surface. There's so much more to talk about this. And I hope maybe one of these days we can chat again. I appreciate it very much.
This is great, John. Thanks so much for having me, and keep up the good work at University of Nebraska.
Well, thank you so much. Sharath Ganji is a fellow at the Center for New American Security and the director of the Autocracy and Global Sports Initiative. And he's our guy to go to when we try to understand what sports washing is, and really not just what sports washing is, but really how it works. So thanks.
Thank you.